Tom Woods Show, episode 2006.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Today, I thought I would take some time to go through the decision of the Fifth Circuit to affirm the stay of the Biden vaccine mandates. I'm sure I'm not alone in thinking that the vaccine mandate is the most important issue in the United States right now. So I wanted to see what the reasoning was behind the court's decision. So I'm going to run through this. I'm going to post the whole document, if you'd like to read it yourself, at tomwoods.com/2006. On November 6th, the court issued a stay. They said that they would stay the mandate, which is to say they would, in effect, stop its implementation pending briefing and expedited judicial review. And now they say in this document of November 12th, having conducted that expedited review, we reaffirm our initial stay. Of course, I think most people know the terms of the mandate, which is that companies with 100 or more employees would have to have all their employees vaccinated or undergo weekly testing and wear masks. And it's not clear exactly where the cost of the testing would fall, but presumably the worker's going to have to bear that on some level anyway. The court points out that the petitioners in the case have standing, so it can proceed. That is to say that the matter at hand affects them directly. And so the court explains, their standing to sue is obvious. The mandate imposes a financial burden upon them by deputizing their participation in OSHA's regulatory scheme. Because remember, the mandate is being carried through via the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. They're claiming that this body deals with health matters in the workplace, and so this is how we're going to enforce this. So anyway, so it does that. It exposes them to severe financial risk if they refuse or fail to comply, and threatens to decimate their workforces and business prospects by forcing unwilling employees to take their shots, take their tests, or hit the road. Now, how does a court decide if it should issue a stay? Well, the Fifth Circuit lays out the four traditional requirements for consideration. The first is whether the stay applicant has made a strong showing that he is likely to succeed on the merits, so that when the whole thing is over and it's all been thought through and analyzed thoroughly, there's a likelihood that the petitioner is going to win. Second, whether the applicant will be irreparably injured absent a stay. Third, whether issuance of the stay will substantially injure the other parties interested in the proceeding. And four, where the public interest lies. And the court says each of these factors favors a stay here. So the court then says, we begin by stating the obvious. The Occupational Safety and Health Act, which created OSHA, was enacted by Congress to assure Americans, quote, safe and healthful working conditions and to preserve our human resources. It was not, and likely could not be, under the Commerce Clause and Non-Delegation Doctrine, intended to authorize a Workplace Safety Administration in the deep recesses of the federal bureaucracy to make sweeping pronouncements on matters of public health affecting every member of society in the profoundest of ways. Now, the Commerce Clause, that's a thing we've talked about, and I have a chapter on the Commerce Clause I talk about it in my book Nullification, and I have a chapter on it in 33 Questions About American History You're Not Supposed to Ask. So there's more detail about that there. Well, I'll just say for now that the Commerce Clause refers to the wording in the U.S. Constitution about the regulation of interstate commerce. Now, there's been a lot of arguing back and forth as to exactly what that means. And as I say, I go through all that evidence in the works I just cited. But the question that the court will consider a little bit later is whether this really could fall under the definition of commerce or anything that the Commerce Clause was ever intended to apply to. So we'll get to that a little bit later. The non-delegation doctrine has to do with the ability of Congress to delegate its legislative authority to executive agencies like OSHA. So the presumption is that it cannot create something like OSHA, and then OSHA just goes ahead and establishes society-wide policies of the profoundest import, absent further legislative activity by Congress. That is to say, it's Congress's role to decide these various things. And of course, many of these things would be beyond the purview of Congress constitutionally as well, but they certainly can't delegate. In effect, they would be delegating lawmaking authority to agencies like OSHA, and they can't do that. So that's what the non-delegation doctrine has to say. And the court is saying that when you consider that, it cannot be the case that OSHA would be, you know, it's one thing for OSHA to say you should wear hard hats in this particular workplace setting. It's quite another for it to say, in effect, 80% of Americans are required to take a vaccine. That's a bit of a stretch. So what the administration is trying to do is to use OSHA and to enact an OSHA ETS, Emergency Temporary Standard. And that's what this vaccine mandate would amount to. So the court makes a note in one of the footnotes that it's not quite clear the nature of this emergency. It seems like an odd emergency where the president says September, something like September 9th, that we're going to do this mandate because of this emergency. And then the issuing of the mandate happens nearly two full months later, November 5th. And then the mandate itself then involves a further two-month delay. Well, if this were the Black Death and it were an emergency of that type, would we really be looking at a four-month delay here? So they're just doing that to look at prima facie evidence as to whether or not this really is an emergency, and frankly, whether or not the administration, in its heart of hearts, honestly considers it to be an emergency. These emergency temporary standards are held to be an unusual response to exceptional circumstances. And so the court says that previous courts have uniformly observed that the authority of OSHA to establish these ETSs, or emergency temporary standards, is an extraordinary power that is to be delicately exercised in only certain limited situations. So they're quoting a previous decision there. But they say that this particular mandate is anything but a delicate exercise of this extraordinary power. And I like their language here. They say, rather than a delicately handled scalpel, the mandate is a one-size-fits-all sledgehammer that makes hardly any attempt to account for differences in workplaces and workers that have more than a little bearing on workers' varying degrees of susceptibility to the supposedly grave danger the mandate purports to address. So then the court looks at the language that's used in authorizing an ETS, that is to say, what would be the requirements necessary for an ETS to be considered? And so they go through some of this. And so some of the language involves dangerous substances or agents that are present in a workplace, or they use the phrase toxic or physically harmful. The court says that that type of language seems to place an airborne virus beyond the purview of an OSHA ETS in the first place. And they say, OSHA's attempt to shoehorn an airborne virus that is both widely present in society and thus not particular to any workplace and non-life-threatening to a vast majority of employees, to take that and try to have that fit into a phrase involving toxicity and poisonousness appears to be rather a transparent stretch. And then they say a natural first step in enacting a lawful ETS is to show that employees covered by the ETS are in fact exposed to the dangerous substances, agents, or hazards at issue, here COVID-19. And in defending the mandate, the government credits OSHA with, and this is a quotation, describing myriad studies showing workplace COVID-19 clusters and outbreaks and other significant evidence of workplace transmission and exposure. But the court says this misses the mark, as OSHA is required to make findings of exposure or at least the presence of COVID-19 in all covered workplaces. Of course, OSHA cannot possibly show that every workplace covered by the mandate currently has COVID-positive employees or that every industry covered by the mandate has had or will have outbreaks. But then they say that it remains unclear that COVID-19, and it says, however tragic and devastating the pandemic has been, poses the kind of danger that's contemplated in the drafting of the authorization for ETSs in the first place. They say that the mandate itself concedes that the effects of COVID-19 may range from mild to critical. And then they say, as important, the status of the spread of the virus has varied since the president announced the general parameters of the mandate in September. And of course, this all assumes that COVID-19 poses any significant danger to workers to begin with. For the more than 78% of Americans aged 12 and older, either fully or partially inoculated against it, the virus poses, the administration assures us, little risk at all. And here they cite in the Federal Register, quote, COVID-19 vaccines authorized or approved by the FDA effectively protect vaccinated individuals against severe illness and death from COVID-19. So the court is taking the federal government at its word about what the vaccines accomplish. Now, of course, here I'm just giving a summary. They're going to have more detailed explanations of all of these points. Then they say we're going to talk now about the necessity of the mandate, which they describe using the phrase staggeringly overbroad. They say it applies to 2 out of 3 private sector employees in America and in workplaces as diverse as the country itself. And it fails to consider the most salient fact of all, that the ongoing threat of COVID-19 is more dangerous to some employees than to other employees. And they give as an example a 28-year-old truck driver who spends most of the day sitting in his cab all by himself is obviously less vulnerable than a 62-year-old prison janitor. And then likewise, a naturally immune unvaccinated worker is presumably at less risk than an unvaccinated worker who has never had the virus. The list goes on, but one constant remains. The mandate fails almost completely to address or even respond to much of this reality and common sense. And so they say this is an immensely complex situation. Is a one-size-fits-all mandate really appropriate in this situation? Now, remember, they use the phrase staggeringly overbroad to refer to the mandate. But at the same time, they're also going to say that the mandate is under-inclusive. They say the most vulnerable worker in America draws no protection from the mandate if his company employs 99 workers or fewer. The point that they're making here is not that we would be happier if the mandate applied to all businesses, whether or not they have 100 or more employees. When they say that the mandate is under-inclusive, that's not their point. Their point, rather, is that this seems to belie the claims that we are really dealing with an emergency. And they say under-inclusiveness of this sort is often regarded as a telltale sign that the government's interest in enacting a liberty-restraining pronouncement is not, in fact, compelling. And then they say further, the under-inclusive nature of the mandate implies that the mandate's true purpose is not to enhance workplace safety, which is what OSHA is supposed to be all about, but instead to ramp up vaccine uptake by any means necessary. And by the way, those of you who are on my mailing list, you got my email over the weekend about the statements I found in Canada being made by medical officials and by various departments openly admitting that the purpose of their vaccine passport system is not to halt the spread of the virus. I mean, they even say it in so many words. It's to encourage vaccine uptake. It really is to punish the unvaccinated. So your friends who are hypochondriacs who say that the vaccine passport system makes me feel safe, well, that's really super, but that's not the point of it. And they just came right out and said that. One medical professional in Canada even said in a big roundtable discussion of this that we're not actually seeing transmission in movie theaters and gyms and restaurants and so forth. So the purpose of the vaccine mandate is not to make people in those venues safer. It's to make the unvaccinated think twice about being unvaccinated because we're going to shut them off from society. They came right out and said that. So again, I can't emphasize enough, the full Tom Woods experience is not the podcast alone. Got to be on that mailing list. You can do that right at the top of the screen at tomwoods.com. You can't be running an ad blocker because then the little pop-up to insert your email address can't appear. So you got to turn that off. But you'll see at the top of the page that you get one of my free ebooks, and plus you get added to the list. So you just click the little red sign me up button and you go from there. Hey, everybody, let's thank our sponsor, BetterHelp. Let's face it, a lot of us had a really, really difficult 2020. And I think a lot of people looked forward to 2021 as a year when things would get a lot better for them. And frankly, that didn't work out for a lot of people. And a lot of people are still struggling with issues like depression and anxiety, which, if not brought on by 2020, were very likely exacerbated by it. And of course, there are still other issues that stand between you and happiness. Maybe you're struggling in your relationships, or you're having sleep problems, or trying to overcome trauma or grief. You've got problems within your family. All these kinds of things can be helped. And that's why BetterHelp exists. They'll match you up with your own licensed professional therapist. You can communicate with that person anytime you want through messages and, of course, through video or phone sessions. And just in case that counselor turns out not to be a perfect fit for you, you can get another one easily. It's convenient and affordable. You should check out the testimonials they post every day on their website. And in fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/woods. Okay, anyway, now we get to the Commerce Clause part that I mentioned earlier. And by the way, this, now we get to the ending part of the decision. And to me, these are the most convincing arguments of all. I mean, naturally, a court has to go back and examine the original statutory language behind the creation of something like OSHA in order to see whether it's what's being proposed to do through OSHA goes beyond its original purpose. That I understand. But to me, there's a more fundamental question, which is, you know, is the federal government authorized to be in this business in the first place, really? And so they say, first, the mandate likely exceeds the federal government's authority under the Commerce Clause, because the idea behind, let's say, the modern interpretation of the Commerce Clause is that the federal government can regulate some economic activity that goes from one state to another. Now, the original meaning of the Commerce Clause is another matter. But what the court is saying here is we're not dealing with economic activity between states. We're dealing with non-economic inactivity. Somebody who chooses to remain unvaccinated and also to forego regular testing, well, that choice is a case of non-economic inactivity, the very opposite of anything even the broadest reading of the Commerce Clause could reach. And in fact, the court says that very thing pretty much in so many words. The Commerce Clause power may be expansive, says the court, but it does not grant Congress the power to regulate non-economic inactivity traditionally within the state's police power. So that is to say, if anybody has this authority under our constitutional federal system, it's the states. It is certainly not the federal government. And maybe even the states, you know, shouldn't have this power, although the court seems inclined to say that they do, simply on the grounds that if you have a federal system and the federal government has delegated only certain enumerated powers, then, well, what follows from that is that all other powers remain in the hands of the states. Now, whether citizens want to restrain those state powers, well, that's a matter to be decided at the state level within state constitutions. Second, the court says that concerns over separation of power principles cast doubt over the mandate's assertion of virtually unlimited power to control individual conduct under the guise of a workplace regulation. The mandate, the court continues, derives its authority from an old statute employed in a novel manner, imposes nearly $3 billion in compliance costs, involves broad medical considerations that lie outside of OSHA's core competencies, and purports to definitively resolve one of today's most hotly debated political issues. And then, skipping ahead further, there is no clear expression of congressional intent to convey OSHA such broad authority, and this court will not infer one. Nor can the Article II executive, that is the president and his administration, breathe new power into OSHA's authority, no matter how thin patience wears. And what they mean by that is, you probably heard Biden's statement that, you know, we've waited and been reasonable up to now, but our patience is wearing thin, you know, with unvaccinated people. They quoted him as saying that earlier. And so they're saying, we don't care how impatient you are, you can't just invent a new power for OSHA. They say in a footnote, hard hats and safety goggles, this is not. So that is to say, this is a huge, monumental, sweeping policy decision that affects basically all of society. It's not a matter of, well, you should wear safety goggles in this particular situation, which is what we normally associate with OSHA. And then, of course, when dealing with a stay, you have to consider whether there would be harm done, irreparable harm done, in the absence of the stay. And they say that, well, it's clear that there would be. For one, the mandate threatens to substantially burden the liberty interests of reluctant individual recipients to put a choice between their jobs and their jabs. And then they say further on, likewise, the companies seeking a stay in this case will also be irreparably harmed in the absence of a stay, whether by the business and financial effects of a lost or suspended employee, compliance and monitoring costs associated with the mandate, the diversion of resources necessitated by the mandate, or by OSHA's plan to impose stiff financial penalties on companies that refuse to punish or test unwilling employees. And then they also make the Federalist point that the states, too, have an interest in seeing their constitutionally reserved police power over public health policy defended from federal overreach. And then they say a stay is in the public interest. Remember, that's another one of the considerations. From economic uncertainty to workplace strife, the mere specter of the mandate has contributed to untold economic upheaval in recent months. Of course, the principles at stake when it comes to the mandate are not reducible to dollars and cents. The public interest is also served by maintaining our constitutional structure and maintaining the liberty of individuals to make intensely personal decisions according to their own convictions, even or perhaps particularly, and they italicize the word particularly, when those decisions frustrate government officials. And then finally, the court reminds us about the limited legislative power Congress has and that they have used this power to delegate policymaking specifics and technical details to executive agencies that are charged with bringing about policy principles that Congress lays down. Now, that is generally well and good most of the time, says the court. But health agencies don't make housing policy, and occupational safety administrations don't make health policy. In seeking to do so here, OSHA runs afoul of the statute from which it draws its power and likely violates the constitutional structure that safeguards our individual liberty. And then, for these reasons, the petitioner's motion for a stay pending review is granted. And then the very last sentence, in addition, it is further ordered that OSHA take no steps to implement or enforce the mandate until further court order. All right, so as I say, I'm going to link to this document at tomwoods.com/2006 so you can read it for yourself if you'd like. And before I wrap up for today, I would like to tell you, now it's true that this is one of my listeners and I'm biased toward my listeners, but I'm genuinely quite happy with the articles on this site I want to tell you about. And that's Michael Deviney's site, and that's mrdeviney.com, mrdeviney.com. Because here's a libertarian who takes some of the key issues that we deal with and really analyzes them in great depth. So he's got pieces on what ownership means, and that ownership, of course, is at the heart of the libertarian project because it begins with the ownership of yourself. And if you say, well, you can't really own yourself, what we mean by ownership is that you have the right to control a particular thing. Well, there's nobody, if you don't like the idea of self-ownership, you don't like that language, well, then just get rid of the language, just keep the concept, which is that there's no other person on earth who has a greater claim to controlling what happens with your body and what you do with your body than you. Prima facie, there's no other person on this earth who has that. The same way if you own an automobile, there's nobody else on this earth who has a greater claim on what happens to that automobile than you. Well, likewise, entrepreneurship and what the value of entrepreneurship is, or why it is that we just kind of accept the idea that we should have a monopoly of money and that it should be issued by one issuer. And there are problems that come from this. Also, the mechanisms used to foster and then later exploit fear in the population. Really good pieces that I recommend. So check it out, mrdeviney.com, mrdeviney.com. I'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/2006. And remember, I would be very happy to give publicity to a site that you're creating. As long as you use my link to get your hosting, you'll get hosting from a great, highly reputable company at a great price. And I'll also give you an opportunity to join my private bloggers group where we all help each other. That doesn't cost you anything. These are all freebies I give you. You got to get hosting anyway. Might as well get the Woods freebies with it. And I'll also promote you on the show and send you some tutorials to help get you up and running super fast. So a lot of great bonuses you get just by using my link that to get something you got to get anyway. Details on all this can be found at tomwoods.com/publicity. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.